Tonight, we have the distinct and rare privilege of hearing a great contemporary Catholic educator, Dr. David Whalen, speak on one of the most influential Catholic educators in recent memory, the ever-challenging and engaging John Sr. As we can see by the enthusiasm and the size of the crowd here tonight, the state and future of Christian culture, the transmission of which we call education, is a topic of great moment to communities like this one. As a professor at Hillsdale College for the past 20 years, Dr. Whalen has devoted much thought and labor to how students are awakened to wonder by an experience of the true, the good, and the beautiful. As the college's provost, he's had cause to reflect upon the cumulative effect of these individual experiences on the culture of a campus, and in turn on the families, churches, and local communities which those students become a part of as adults. At Hillsdale now, and previously at Belmont Abbey College in the University of Kansas, Dr. Whalen has taught Victorian and modern British literature and great books. He also teaches upper-level courses on the liberal arts, lyric poetry, and the writings of Blessed John Henry Newman. Now it gives me special pleasure to introduce Dr. Whalen because of the particular role he's played in my own spiritual and intellectual development. I first met Dr. Whalen a decade ago when, as a high school senior, I attended a short summer study abroad trip with a number of other prospective Hillsdale College students. At the time, my father signed me up for this trip, largely against my will. I intended to enroll at a state school and double major in biology and chemistry. However, this particular course was devoted to studying a handful of Shakespeare's plays while exploring the Bard's native England. Dr. Whalen was one of four professors brave enough to lead this rabble. After 2 weeks of discussing poetry, trying the black pudding, talking late into the night, and attending my first Mass, the example of Dr. Whalen's intellect and joy persuaded me that Hillsdale College might just have something to offer. Now, having once allowed the melancholy Dane and admired Miranda into my imagination, it wasn't long until I left off pursuing biology and chemistry and decided to double major instead in English and classics. Now, just as Dr. Whalen played a role in introducing me to Shakespeare, so too he brought about my introduction to Catholicism, largely through the works of Blessed John Henry Newman. Every college student and every convert has the great joy of feeling as though they're the first traveler on the road to Damascus or Emmaus, as the case may be. But of course, my experience isn't an unusual one. In fact, those of you who know of John Sr., whose work Dr. Whalen is here to discuss tonight, are likely familiar with the similar trajectory experienced by some 200 or more students involved in the Integrated Humanities program at the University of Kansas, where Dr. Whalen himself completed his bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees. Like John Sr. before him, Dr. Whalen is an educator who realizes that learning begins in wonder and ends in wisdom, that we begin by awakening deep and abiding loves in children and by starting them on the path of rightly ordering those loves. So once again, let me say what a great privilege it is to welcome tonight's speaker, Dr. David Whalen.
Well, see, now that's just no good at all. I was going to tease him by saying every good thing he said about me was a lie. And then he became autobiographical and started giving me credit for things of personal import, which is probably the part that's a lie, but you can't say that to somebody, right? Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. It's an honor to be here. I am going to deposit some of these materials on the floor so I can trip over them later. If I reach for that little book that I just dropped, you know things are getting desperate, because that's a book of poetry by a colleague of Dr. Senior's, and there are some marvelous poems in there. And as Zach might, and others here might tell you, if I start reading a lot of poetry, that means I'm tired of hearing myself speak, and I'd rather listen to the poets. As I say, it is indeed a pleasure and an honor to be here, especially because an invitation to speak about John Sr., the man, and John Sr.'s thought is a rare privilege to pay in that manner in which one does pay a debt that is ultimately unpayable, it is an opportunity, an occasion to pay a debt of gratitude to John Sr. He is probably the single most influential, other than my parents, he's probably the single most important and influential person I've encountered in my 53, nearly 54 years now. He's impossible to describe. He was not some crazy mystic character that would impress everyone just by walking into a room. He was much deeper than that. It was much more profound than some sort of pseudo-spirituality a la Hollywood. But his greatness became quickly apparent and grew in one's apprehension the more one knew him. So to talk about John Sr., to talk about his thought, is, as I say, an occasion of gratitude. The thing perhaps, in a certain respect, Zach's introduction touched on the key points, or some of the key points, thank you, of my talk tonight. When I arrived, when I saw how many people were here, I was really quite taken aback. I mean, John Sr. died in, what was it, 1999, and he lived a long way away. Don't think he spent any time in Michigan if he was ever here. What would a parish buried in Grand Rapids, what interest could there be in John Sr.? I certainly knew it wasn't interest in me, but then I saw the wine and beer, and oh, okay, now I understand. Okay, that's right. And it is 1 week after Easter, so that will draw the crowd. But Zach's introduction did touch on some key points, particularly the heart of Sr.'s thought. I actually hesitate to say very quickly or readily what I think the heart of his thought was, because it to do so, I often tell students, if you can put something in a nutshell, it belongs there. To give somebody a formula is the opposite of teaching, right? To give them a formula gives them a means of not learning a thing. They don't have to learn it because they have the formula. They don't really digest it. They don't understand it. They don't, what's the cliche today? They don't internalize it, but they think they know something because they can reproduce the formula. So I sort of hesitate to put the engine or the driving force of his thought in propositional form. But if I had to do so, you see, I preface the very thing I say I don't like to do. Now I'm going to do it. I would say that it is a curious, a fascinating form of love. Overused word, I'm sorry. I know we're all sick of hearing about love, perhaps, but John Sr. loved, this may sound paradoxical, maybe a little unorthodox, but he loved the world. He loved it passionately and profoundly and deeply. He was a great teacher, but in his heart of hearts, he was a kind of poetic philosopher, or maybe a philosophical poet. Maybe that's the proper order. And you can't be that without looking at things around you and outside of you, and in some sense being drawn out of yourself, being drawn toward that something, being, Zach mentioned, wonder, being elevated in a state or condition of wonder by the very being of that thing, and then calling the attention of others to that being. That's what poets do. And that's very much what Sr. did his entire life. Drew the attention of others, whether in his few poems or much more commonly, of course, in his classes, in his conversations, drew the attention of others to the real thing, whatever that thing is. Some of you might know G.K. Chesterton has a little book called The Thing, and I mean the thing in that Chestertonian sense. That is that fundamental deposit of reality. Sr. would draw others' attention to that in the fashion and in the work of a kind of poet. So he was deeply in love with the world, but knew very well that the world, the fall has done wonderful things, right? The world can only be properly loved. And by properly, I don't mean just morally rightly. I mean it can only be loved efficaciously if God is loved first. Nothing fails like at being worldly, like worldliness. And that's the paradox. Nothing fails in being worldly like worldliness. If you're a kind of Catholic worldliness can embrace with passionate, almost devout love the world precisely because God is loved, not just more in some sort of quantitative way, but the author of the world is loved primarily, and the world is loved as his handiwork. Now, again, just to put that in a nutshell, sounds like a nice piety, perhaps, although maybe a disconcerting one at first, to talk about loving the world and worldliness. But it is true of John Sr. He was a profoundly reflective and thoughtful man, profoundly perceptive. The articulation that you detect in his works when you read him, you've heard this before perhaps, and I apologize to repeat it, but it was nothing compared to his viva voce conversation. His books are terrific, but those of us who for some mysterious reason known in only to the mind of God, were blessed to have him as a professor, know that these books, great as they are, serve best to us as reminders of the deeper greatness in his conversation. So, enough of introductory matter. Let me begin, or rather, let me conclude my introduction to this address by reading one of his poems entitled "Contemptus." I'm an English professor, so I do this. I have a captive audience. I was at a faculty meeting this morning, and I came this close to reading a poem to the entire faculty. You know, that's how cruel I can be. Just ask my former students here. Contemptus Mundi. These poems are touched with a kind of wit and twinkle in the eye. How great the joys of heaven are that need no April to recover, or surprise, no lilacs, nor the pumpkins of October. There they need no sun and rainbows of emerald. Why must we burn in heart and brain by flaming fickleness enthralled? Two ways to make contemptible the world. The first is not to look. The second, and more sensible, to read it like a book. To learn the grammar and the word, loving not the less but more, contemning it as music heard supersedes the score. Now, I won't teach the poem, I promise, and I won't even reread the whole thing, but I will reread the last two stanzas, the last two quatrains. Two ways to make, remember what I said about loving the world and loving God, two ways to make contemptible the world. Remember, the title of the poem is Contemptus Mundi, Contempt of the World, a highly praised attribute of the spiritually rich. Two ways to make contemptible the world. The first is not to look. The second, and more sensible. Now, he's punning when he says sensible. He's including the senses, right? The physical senses. The second, and more sensible, to read it like a book. Many of you no doubt are hearing that great patristic and medieval comparison of the world to the Bible. God is said, you recall, to be the author of two books, the book of the world and the book of the Bible. And it is our task to read both books. Then the second and more sensible, to read it like a book, to learn the grammar and the word, loving not less but more, contemning it, that is the world, contemning it as music heard supersedes the score. So you see how that works. The music heard is the creator of the world. When you hear Beethoven, You have contempt for the score. Not for the composition, but you put down the page. I mean, I know musicians have to. They're professionally obligated to pay attention to the score as they listen. But you have to admit that's fairly inhuman, right? Something superhuman, subhuman, I don't know, but it isn't human to hear something glorious like Beethoven or Mozart while studying the score. Put the bally thing down and listen, right? That's contempt of the score, right? You, of course, love the score, but you love the music much more. The score is your avenue to the music, right? So to the world, love the world. Senior very much loved the world and loved the author as the music of it, as it were. Okay, I do, by the way, that's the end of my introductory remarks. After this, whatever little excitement you had in that introduction is dead and gone. Now it's time to take a nap. I'm glad you're fortified with wine. I will keep some kind of an eye on time, and I do plan to keep a pretty healthy period available for questions and answers. I understand that there are lots of people here who have different kinds of interest in John Senior, and as I tell my students all the time, ask me anything you wish. What I don't know, I'll simply invent. Okay. So the other perhaps surprising thing to say is, in John Senior's estimation, you know, this book that I was asked to address, The Restoration of Christian Culture, it succeeds another book, a different book, The Death of Christian Culture. Given that, perhaps this statement is unnecessary, but we perhaps should begin by saying that in John Senior's estimation, and I don't mean this to sound apocalyptic or alarmist or, you know, head for the hills, but pretty much, he thought Western civilization was over. This is maybe to continue the musical metaphor. We're in the coda, at best. We're in some post something. Scholars like to talk about the postmodern. Actually, now they even talk about the post-postmodern. All we can do is just add some more posts. It's like fence posts. Just put in another post. You know, post-postmodern. We have the abiding sense that we're after something. Not the sense that we're before anything. Okay, that's the condition of the modern imagination. At least it was John Senior's conviction that Christian culture was pretty much over. It was dead. I think if you look at the newspaper, cheap example, I know. But if you look at the newspaper, you get some kind of confirmation of that. So a recovery of Christian culture, Senior really thought was impossible. Maybe not even desirable, a recovery, but a restoration was essential. Okay, there's a distinction. A recovery is a pulling back the thing that was. A restoration is a kind of new creation, analogous to or an extension of the thing that was. Think about the, you know, recovering a boat or restoring a boat. Two very different actions. So his Restoration of Christian Culture was very much written with this conviction in the background. It is a book of paradoxes, not the flashy Chestertonian paradoxes that make you giggle, although some seniors very humorous. I remember as a student thinking, God, this guy, and you wouldn't think it, but I remember thinking, this guy could be a stand-up comic. Not that that's terribly important, but his sense of humor was so sharp, and I'm sorry, those of you who are in theater will get what I'm pointing at. Even his timing was perfect. You know, the drumbeat, da-dum-bum. He was a remarkably funny man. So there are times when you might laugh when reading him, but no, his paradoxes are a kind of quiet, are a sort of quiet reflection on paradoxes that are buried in the architecture, you might say, in the design of the world. They tend to be hidden. For instance, as I intimated earlier, his book concerns the right order of this world, but for the sake of the next one. So it can sometimes be dizzying to readers, the restoration of Christian culture, because one minute they're talking in the most, one minute they're reading words of the most ecstatic, rapturous sort about the glories of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and the very next paragraph, they're reading about men going to pubs to drink because they're happy and not to get happy. And, how did we get from here to... And yet it seemed effortless and seamless while you were reading it. It's only when you put it down that you realize... And your spouse or somebody asks, so what were you reading about? And then you begin to splutter like a fool. Oh, the Blessed Virgin, the mystical rose and pubs and fireplaces and Dante and this curious Renaissance fashion of opposite mimicking and the Blessed Virgin. So, as I say, it can be hard to follow. The book argues that, another paradox, that the active life of this world, the life, you know, the worldly life, the active life, is invigorated only, at least after Christ, is invigorated only when the retired life, the contemplative life, the retired life of prayer prospers. You don't get to be worldly without contemplatives. I think that's, you ought to laugh at that, just out of courtesy. You know, think about that. I mean, it sounds like a pious point until you think about what it means, right? And then you realize it's rather radical. We only get to be proper, you only get to really enjoy your beer if there are enough monks around who are serious about holiness. Ah, there, now that's a little giggle, okay. Another paradox. He argues that the way for us to advance, the way toward a restoration of Christian culture, is to restore a life of apparent retrogression, that is, a retreat from technological progress and innovation. We live in a world that is enthralled with technological progress, that looks at the newest gimmick. I mean, aren't you all waiting with bated breath for the very next iPhone? And what will it be able to do? It will be able to, you know, read your heartbeat and transmit it to somebody in Beijing effortlessly without you even wanting it to. Oh, joy. If he had lived long enough to see the technological developments of the last 10 years, I think he would die again of laughter. The ridiculousness is so, but he thought that we actually, as a civilization, need to progress, to advance to the restoration of Christian culture by regressing from technology. More about that in a minute. John Senior, I'll give you a little bit of bio, very brief, and then I'll tell you about my introduction to him personally. He was a native of Long Island. He was raised on Long Island, and as a young man, bugged his father so much about wanting to be a cowboy, he was given enough money for a horse and a one-way ticket to Wyoming and kicked out. I'm not making that up. As a middle teenager, he went out to Wyoming and learned to ride horses and to herd cattle. He told the story. This is the poet, right? This is Senior the poet. He told the story about sitting at a rodeo once sitting next to some old geezer of a cowboy, and he saw this guy come out, this cowboy breaking a horse, you know, riding a bronco, and he was good. He was really good. And Senior said, I turned to the cowboy next to me and said, wow, he's so good. He looks like he's part of the horse. See, now I'd be proud of myself if I said that. That's kind of a poetic way of expressing that. You know, he's so good, he looks like he's part of the horse. That's impressive. This old cowboy said, watch the next guy. He's better. He makes the horse look like it's part of him. Okay? So, and Senior, the reason he told that story isn't just because it's a neat story. What happens is the instrument becomes part of you. Those roles are reversed. You know, this instrument is subsumed to your commanding performance, right? So you have to subject yourself to it in order to subject it to yourself. And that's a profound observation about the nature of excellence in craft, whether we're talking about plumbing or concert piano playing or poetry writing or poetry reading, for that matter, or teaching. That was something that, again, you could tell Senior was picking up these insights all the time. And anyway, he Later, he went to Columbia and studied with Mark Van Doren, a very famous poet, American poet and professor who taught in the Columbia Great Books Program, founded by John Erskine a generation earlier. After that, he taught at a few colleges back east, moved back to Wyoming, taught there for a little bit. There are some early cassettes, some recordings of Senior giving lectures about Blessed John Henry Newman to seminarians in Wyoming in, I think, 1963 or something. Those are pure gold. He then moved to the University of Kansas, and with Dennis Quinn and Frank Nellick, two other professors, started the Integrated Humanities Program, which became famous, or I should say infamous, for the number of its converts. The Kansas City Star, the daily paper in Kansas City, had a front-page story. I kid you not. I've got a copy of this at home. A front-page story. And you know how modest staid, old-fashioned newspapers are. They don't like big headlines, and they don't like splashy graphics. They didn't used to. Now they're all competing with U.S. What's that paper? USA Today? Right. They're all competing with Flash, so everybody's being flashy. But anyway, this paper, this was in the old-fashioned, staid, conservative days of the front page. But nevertheless, they had a 3-inch tall graphic going from left to right across the entire page. On the left was the drawing of a hippie. You know, the bell bottoms and long hair and the patches, the holes and the patches in the clothes, you know, probably a joint in his ass, something. And there was this evolutionary progression of gradual change until over on the right was a monk. So this hippie gradually turned into a Benedictine monk and, you know, pretty good for the Kansas City Star. And that was because that issue had a big, long story about the Integrated Humanities Program and these wild, crazy, irresponsible professors who were turning everything that stood still into a Catholic. stones, you know, pillars, floor tiles, whatever. I was completely unaware of all of this. I went to the University of Kansas for dull and unimaginative reasons. It was in the backyard, as it were. I grew up in Kansas City. But I had heard of this great books program, and I had seen the list of books that were taught in this program, and they were all the books that everyone ought to have read. And I had read a few of them, but not very many. And I was nerdy and bookish enough to think, ooh, I should do that. I should read all those. That would be cool. I had not heard of any controversy. I had not heard of John Senior. I had not heard of anything. I just saw a book list. Well, I went to the university freshman year. The week before classes begin, they have what they call orientation. And I learned my first great lesson. I was a protected suburban kid, right? I learned my first great lesson in bureaucracy. I kid you not. I remember in one instance in particular, I stood in a line for 4 hours. You know, I'm a docile, sort of obedient suburban kid. I should have burned the place down, but, you know, stood in line for 4 hours only to be told when I got to the front of it, oh, no, you don't have to drop and add this. It was done automatically when you turned in this or that test score. So I went to my classes. The last first class that I went to was the Integrated Humanities, and I had a class in psychology. I had a class in some sort of public speaking. I had a class in this and that, and they were all just kind of more of the same. Do you know what I mean? It was high school, but in a more impressive building. I'm not kidding. And they were good classes. They were fine, just not remarkable. I sit down in this Integrated Humanities. I wonder what this is going to be like. Two men walked in. Now, the year before, I didn't know this at the time, the year before it had been three. Frank Nellick had left the program. Actually, he was trying to draw a fire. It's a long story. I'll tell you later if you want. Two men came in without notes, nothing but Homer's Odyssey, and sat down at a table and started to talk. There was no syllabus, not at first. There was no paperwork. There was no, okay, in this class we're going to have a midterm on such and so, we're going to have a final on such and so. They just began to talk. And the first thing they said, I remember, and I repeat to this day to my students, they said, what you need to understand about this class is that it's serious. And I don't mean grim. I mean it matters. Everything we read in this course matters desperately to you and the way you live and the decisions you have to make. Everything. We're not reading anything of merely historical interest. The lecture went on. I walked out of there on cloud, finally, a class that matters. This now I've got something to look forward to. Instead of just something to get through, I've got something to look forward to. That was my introduction to John Senior. I had never heard of him, had never seen him before. He was a tall, thin man. He had a slightly raspy voice. He looked, if you looked at him, you'd think, ooh, absent-minded professor. And he was a little bit. I remember in one class, this, I won't be too graphic, one class in the back, a class had about 40 people in it. It wasn't huge, smaller than this group. A young lady became ill. She threw up all over the floor. He didn't even notice. You know, he was just talking and he kept right. He didn't notice until she had gotten up and staggered halfway across the room to leave. And then he, what? You know, so he was something of the absent-minded professor, but watch out for those cowboys. You know, just when you think that they're completely abstracted, you know, they pull out the bullwhip, so to speak. So anyway, the John Senior, the author of our book, The Restoration of Christian Culture, as I said, is motivated, driven by a love of the world, which itself is driven by a love of its creator, a love of God, which is why he begins the book with a little Latin phrase that comes from Richard of St. Victor. Actually, I don't know that our source is Richard of St. Victor. It probably antedates Richard. But this phrase, you may have heard it before, ubi amor, ibi oculi. Where there is love, there is the eye, is the key, as it were. I hate keys, you know, but for shorthand, I'll use the phrase, the expression. It's the key to this entire book. Where there is love, there is the eye. Only the lover can actually see the person or the thing beloved. Actually see it. Which has enormous consequences. It sounds very perhaps squishily romantic from a spiritual point of view. It sounds perhaps very lofty and sort of touching on the heels of something vaguely mystical. But it certainly, and in Senior's understanding, it also had a great deal to do with education at all levels. Only the lover can see what a thing is, which means from an educational point of view, the first thing, you mentioned rightly ordered loves, the first educational imperative is to create a context in which students can fall in love with what there's, not with learning, not with a process, but with the thing they're supposed to know. Okay? Once they love, then they can know. And I think, as I tell my students all the time, do not take my word for any of this. Consult your own experience. You cannot really understand a thing until it is loved, until it has captured you. We talk about knowledge, and Senior talked about this all the time. We treat knowledge as if it is something that one masters, as if what you know you have mastered. We even have degrees called master's degrees, right? We treat knowledge as if it is something to dominate, to master, to manipulate, and to control. I have subdued calculus to my apprehension. You know, it took a lot of work. You know, I had to flog it. I shot it a few times with large caliber weapons, but I finally have subdued calculus. It's exactly that. That is the late modern approach to knowledge and understanding. The traditional, even pre-Christian Western understanding of knowledge, especially that order of knowledge that approaches wisdom, but not only that one. More about this later, perhaps, if we have time. But the traditional Western approach is that we know something when we have been mastered by it. When it has taken possession of us. Now, I'm speaking loosely. I'm not speaking with epistemological precision about these things. If I did, I would have to talk about the process, the rational substances, process of abstraction of essences, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But an essence is abstracted by a knowing subject. The thing becomes subject, the person becomes subject to what is known. Okay? So anyway, the point is this ubi amor ibi oculi, though it may sound squishy or vaguely romantic, really is the hard truth about human learning, human education, human relationships, and human spirituality. Yes, certainly that too. But even on the pedestrian level of education, we've got it all wrong. We approach it as a bunch of content to be shoved, truths to be mastered and manipulated by a knowing person, knowing mind, the mind that knows them, when in fact, and we wonder why it doesn't seem to work very well, and we wonder why our scores are plummeting, and we wonder why, you know, generation after, accepting everybody in the room, okay? This is where I get lynched, yeah. Generation after generation seems to get dumber and dumber and dumber. Now, the youngest people in the room are reaching for the fruit to hurl. that's not you, Zutendum. But this principle, as I say, underwrites the entire book. And for Senior, the ubi amor ibi oculi, where there is love, there is the eye, it's not just a cool, interesting feature of human intelligence. The love itself is a kind of, it's not called love because that's the proper category to which it belongs. It is, he calls it in the Restoration, he calls it chivalric, flaming, tempestuous. He opens the book with frequent reference to the Song of Solomon, you know, that one book in the Old Testament that everyone likes to avoid, and those who don't like to avoid it like to read it when no one's around. You know, that's the kind of love. It is passionate, it is intense, it is focused with laser-like intensity. So what's the deal with love? Why is love so important? Because, as he says very early on in the first chapter of the Restoration, we do not get to heaven merely, as we've been told, we do not attain to heaven merely by obeying the commandments. We don't even attain to heaven by loving our neighbor merely. We attain to heaven by loving as Christ has loved us. That's more than just patiently putting up with this smelly old neighbor over here. In that little book, there's a poem called, what's it called? I think it's something like Church on Sunday, and the poem is from the point of view of this rather angry man attending some sort of church service of a Sunday, and he says, "Love thy neighbor, Christ, not this neighbor, not this particular smelly neighbor, smelling of money and poodles. You mean neighborly average. You mean neighbor in the abstract. Get me a theologian." You know, that wasn't written by Senior, but Senior heartily approved of that, but he directed our attention precisely to that poem. The love that Christ has for us is itself, it's joyful, it is passionate, and in every sense of the word, passionate, right? It is a love that Senior describes as joyful, entailing suffering and sacrifice. No one gets to heaven unless they love joyfully in suffering and with sacrifice. That's it. That's the book, so to speak. And so the whole book then is an unfolding of this principle of love. So Christian culture, you might say, is a kind of circularity of love. Now, he doesn't use this. I use this to make my own presentation sound more respectable and academic. But that is, culture, he says, exists in order to shroud, protect, to put a roof over and a floor beneath the mass. The mass is at the center of Christian culture, not just metaphorically at the center. Culture grows up in order to house the mass, which means you need literally housing, but you also need priests, and priests need mothers and fathers, and they need to be fed, you know, and they need to be clothed, and mothers and fathers need to be fed and clothed, and siblings have to keep priests humble because otherwise they go nuts, you know. And so, boom, 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 boom. It turns out you know, culture radiates outward from the Eucharist, from the Mass, and to protect it, and in turn, culture. So culture inclines toward the Mass, and the Mass, as it were, inclines or blossoms forth into culture. If you want to put it this way, you could say that culture exists in order to surround and protect the Mass, which is the sacred heart of Christianity. But also, Senior says, that the Mass and the life of prayer it generates gives birth to culture. So culture protects the Mass, and the Mass gives birth to culture. There's this circularity. Now, with respect, a great deal of the Restoration concerns education. And there, Senior says over and over and over again something we desperately wish were not true. We hope it's not true. We pray it's not true. We fear it's true. And that is that in explication of another medieval phrase, famous phrase, there is nothing in the intellect that is not first in the senses. Again, there's a sort of dry epistemological, philosophical explication of that. Senior's is anything but dry and philosophical. But he points out that the meaning of that sentence, in concrete practical terms, is that we educate our intellects not first by addressing the intellect or the intelligence. We educate the intellect by first addressing the body. Think of children. Think of the very little children. In the Greek tradition, this was known as gymnastic. And no, I don't mean jumping jacks. I mean the training of the body. The body had to be adequated to the world because the body and its uses, its functions, its operations in the world shaped what we now call the imagination. And the imagination itself is the soil out of which, as it were, rationality or reason grows. So in other words, there's a threefold process. There is the shaping, the training, the education of the body in gymnastic, the education of the imagination through music and poetry and story and song. And again, if you just think of children and growing up, you know, they begin by, you take a baby and you dandle it on your knee and you go, boo, you know, ride a cock horse to Banbury Cross, or you go, this is the way the gentleman trots, gentleman trots, gentleman trots. You know, you do that with babies and they go, and they love it. You know, that's what they do. If you said, now, my child, when you can read Descartes, then, you know, we're going to have a conversation. You know, get back to me then. Something's wrong. Something's disordered. And I'm being, you know, absurd in my examples, but you get the point. You begin with the body. You know, you their intelligence. I love, this is a senior-esque kind of comment, but it's true of my own experience. Gosh, I hope I don't embarrass anyone. Those moments, have you bumped into people in the grocery store who are crouching down, reasoning with a three-year-old about the Tootsie Roll or something, and they're trying. Now, you see, there's this thing called private property, and people own things because they have a right to their own bodies, and that body depends on certain material things outside of the body that they also have a right to by extension. It's called an entailment, and because of that entailment, you see, that belongs, and you can, so you actually have to obtain some sort of labor, and the three-year-old, you can tell what they're thinking because you're thinking it too, you know. You're thinking, you're reasoning with a child that is 98% will and 2% appetite. You know, there's no reason yet. I mean, there's a reason. The church talks about an age of reason. you start with the body, and then you move to the imagination, because after you've dandled them on your knee and you've said, you know, this is the way the gentleman trots, the gentleman trots, the gentleman trots, then you've actually snuck poetry in to begin, haven't you, right there? Even though you're bouncing them up and down on your knee, they're getting the idea of rhythm, verbal rhythm. And you move on to Mother Goose and all the nursery rhymes, and then you move on to the stories, the great childhood stories, everything from Aesop's fables to Grimm's fairy tales to Andersen. And if you remember your experience, it often doesn't matter if the child is too young to even understand the story. Now, you don't want to read them Faulkner, for crying out loud. You know, just quit. Just stop. But have you noticed you might be reading a Grimm's fairy tale to your 5- and 6-year-old, but your 3-year-old, who's not really clued in, is nevertheless sitting there rapt. The imagination is being shaped, is being formed. And it is later then that the intellect is addressed, usually through memory, the early stages of education. I'm not going to go through all of this in any detail, but my point is, Senior's point is that as a culture, we have lost sight of human nature. And therefore, we've lost sight of its education. How do you educate that nature? And you begin again with the body, which is why even at the grade school level, by the way, these things are not entirely left behind. You know, you don't graduate out of the body. Okay, you can address my mind now. My body is in the bedroom sleeping. You know, we don't actually leave any of these stages behind. They develop. You know, they're transformed, but they're not abandoned. Even the education of the body, right? I could go into examples, but this I realize I'm already running on a bit long, perhaps. So the schoolboy or schoolgirl of first, second, third grade, a great deal of their activity really ought to be physical. I'm moved to something approaching a kind of despair. Every time I see these really well-intentioned, hard-driving, wonderfully traditional and civilized parents and schoolmasters and teachers boasting of the fact that they got their second graders to read Thucydides in the Greek. It's a fallacy. The faster and the sooner you're doing something, the smarter you and your kids must be. I mean, think about the logic of that. The faster and sooner you do something, the better you must be at it. What wing of human life is actually like that? Almost nothing. Cooking? You know? Carving? Anything? Filling out insurance policy paperwork? I mean, almost none of life actually works that way. But it's a fallacy that we are devoted to. We clutch it to our breasts. You know, I just love speed and efficiency. It is a mistake, and I'm afraid people who have every good intention think they're educating their children far better when they're doing something that usually older kids do. Now, there's a good reason they do that, because we have all learned that older kids are actually learning nothing. It's an understandable mistake. You know, we're going to make sure they learn things, and they're going to be speaking Greek by the third grade. You really need to wait till the fourth grade before they're speaking Greek. But anyway, you get the point. So the gymnastic and what he calls poetry and music, which is not just poetry and it's not just music, it's a capital P, capital M. Anything that addresses the imagination, anything that flames the moral sensibility, because the moral sensibilities are shaped primarily in the imagination. Do you remember, okay, academic parenthesis. Those of you who have studied Aristotle's Ethics might remember very early on, he talks about how important it is to have, for ethical reasoning about ethics, how important it is that someone has had a good upbringing. Do you remember that? This is where I tell my students, just nod your head. Just do this. Whether you've read it or not, just do you remember that? Well, that's what Aristotle's talking about. If your imagination has been shaped, if it has been sort of inflamed by the tales of George Washington's heroism, you know, and the sacrifice and or the courage of Cincinnatus, you know, Cincinnatus. If the imagination has been inflamed by the passions and the heroic deeds of this and that and the next thing, then when you come to reason about courage, when you come to actually do the philosophy of ethical reasoning, you can do it. But if someone was never inflamed, if their imaginations were never animated, driven to wonder at the kind of noble self-sacrifice of this dog, you know, that attacked the bear and let the child run away home safe while the dog died fighting this unequal battle. You know, if the kid has never had that kind of excitement, not only will the kid not know courage when he or she encounters it, but the kid will not even be able to think about courage clearly. Okay, so this is Senior's point about the education of the senses, the education of the imagination, which is then followed by the education of the intellect or the reason. So because this is human nature, he then suggests prescriptively that we need to do something in order to cultivate that nature, in order to Christianize it, in order to Christianize our culture or restore a culture that is Christian, it is Catholic. And that is, he says, at several points, to our shock and horror, smash the TV. He actually uses that verb, smash the TV. We would say, shoot the computer screen. There is a very strong, is usually derisively described as Luddite strain in John Senior's thinking, and I would like to talk about that a little bit. Maybe it'll come up in Q&A. But fundamentally, Senior understood that the education of both the senses and the imagination was, every pun is intended, short-circuited by the radical passivity of modern media. That there are two things that have happened with the advent of technologized life. And by technology, I just don't mean electronics. I mean pretty much anything post-industrial revolution. Two things have happened. We have insulated and isolated ourselves from the order of nature, right? We have exercised a command over the order of nature in such a way as our senses are no longer habituated to the natural properties of creation. Okay, just now, from a Catholic point of view, that's in itself a problematic idea, right? If creation is made by God, if we are made by God, if our senses are to be adequated, if the book of the world, remember Contemptus Mundi, if the book of the world is to be read, you have to actually be in the book of the world. Well, I don't mean to be critical of my hosts, but look around you right now. The air we're breathing is temperature controlled. The light that we have is mediated, right? This isn't sunlight we're dealing with. This isn't natural light. We are dressed, we move and live and have our beings in a man-made, not natural, environment. Now, you might think, was Senior some kind of hippie? Well, no, but he was Catholic who understood that God made the world and man's sensibilities proportionate to each other. And the degree to which we remain ignorant of the natural rhythms and life and expression of the created order, the more we live in a mediated order of our own making, the less our sensibilities, as it were, are prepared for actual reasoning. So he goes on to say that the experiment, the great books programs that we have in the world have actually failed. They have largely failed. And not because of any bad intent, but rather because the students' sensibilities and their imagination, first of all, the students have not been raised up. Their imaginations have not been shaped by the things that have traditionally shaped the imagination of the West. They have been shaped by Sesame Street or some, you know, excrescence like that. I hope I haven't offended any real diehard Sesame Street fans in the, but what about Big Bird? I mean, you know what I mean. That is, our imaginations are pretty tepid, as are our sensibilities and our understanding of natural phenomena. He tells the story in the Restoration of trying to teach Chaucer, a great book, a great author, right? Trying to cheat The Nun's Priest tale concerns Chanticleer, a rooster who engages in Thomistic scholastic disputation with his wife, Dame Pertolota. Okay, now, that's funny. That's your cue to laugh. That's funny. But it's even funnier if you know how roosters behave. And the problem is you can only half teach that thing because nobody in the classroom has spent any time around. I've actually been in a class. This is true. I've been in a class where the behavior, and I'm not Mr. Natural, you know, you don't see me in camos, do you? but where the behavior of deer is actually important to the story. And one kid out of a class of 30 going, oh, you know, because he had spent enough time with a rifle in his hands out, you know, hunting. He actually got what the story was, or what that element of the story was about. And everyone else is, it's an abstraction, unmoved. So Senior is talking about that, but not just about this or that quaint episode, which requires you to understand how beans grow. What he's talking about is a pervasive inculture. What have we been enculturated into? And it isn't the created order. And therefore, our sensibilities have not been proportioned, as it were, have not been shaped in a proportionate way, experienced in a proportionate way to the book of the world. And therefore, when you and I start thinking about the world, we're lousy at it. We're just terrible at it. And we don't know it the way lovers know anything. Because you can't, there's a paradox in this, right? Not only can you not know something until you love it, you have to know something of a thing before you can love it. And we know next to nothing of creation on the sensory level. For us, they're all headshots. It's all abstraction. But nothing is in the intellect, which is not first in the senses. So yes, it is, you know, you can consider it hippie if you wish, but there is something about our experience of the natural world proportioning our sensibilities and rendering them susceptible then, or rendering our reasoning susceptible to the kind of, it's a plant organic metaphor, right? The imagination is the soil out of which the reason grows. And if that soil is depleted, you're not going to get much in the way of reasoning. I see, I really am going long. Let me say something else about education, and then I'll wrap up pretty quickly. And I do, as I say, I'm probably going to be more helpful to you in answering questions than in rambling. In an important section of this book, Dr. Senior talks about the rule of Saint Benedict. And again, a superficial or cursory review of the book might think that it is simply a hobby horse. He's got some particular fascination with things Benedictine. What could this have to do with civilization at large or education in particular? And Dr. Senior's answer would be a very short one word, everything. He says that the virtues articulated in the opening words of the prologue of The Rule contain all the seeds, in principle, all the seeds for effective Christian education and indeed Christian culture. In Senior's translation, that's, "Hear, my son, the precepts of the teacher, and incline the ears of thy heart to accept the admonitions of loving Father freely and fulfill them." We begin by listen. Hear, my son, the precepts of the teacher. Listening. Senior discusses that listening is not simply the passive the passive posture of auditory receptivity, but rather one only listens in a condition of silence. And the silence is not merely external, but it's interior as well. An interior silence is achieved when the right order of reason, will, appetite, and passion obtains. And it, most of us are still, I'll speak for myself, I am still very much working on that right ordering, which means I am not very capable of listening terribly well, even now, right? That is, to have a condition of interior silence so that one can hear, one needs to have his reason in command of his passions and will and appetites. Unruly things, they. And then the one is to listen. This silence is to be penetrated by the admonitions of the teacher, which means a posture not only of silence, but of docility. Docility actually means just teachable, but docility we understand to mean a kind of willingness, a kind of desire or hunger for what is to be learned. And thus, Senior argues, a friendship, this entails or implies a kind of friendship between the teacher and the student, not a friendship predicated on equality, not that kind of Aristotelian friendship, but a friendship that is analogous to the friendship between God and man. Very much not one of equality, right? But nevertheless, one actuated by a kind of love for each other, as well as a love for the things being learned. Okay, God loves his creation too, right? To love the things that God loves is a step toward deepening the spiritual life. Well, this docility, this listening and receptivity in friendship to the teachings, the admonitions of the teacher, then results in that famous Benedictine conversion of heart, conversion of what they call conversion of manners. Now, Senior goes on in depth about what does it mean what does the conversion of manners mean? And I don't have time to go into it here. And you all think that's a dodge, I know, but just ask me about it in Q&A, and then we can spend some time on it. You're my excuse. But suffice it to say that conversion of manners is actually the seedbed of Christian or Catholic civilization and culture. That what happens when you have a vibrant contemplative culture, and by that I mean not that everybody's a monk, I mean that everybody has a life of prayer, or at least that a prayer life is presumptive of everyone. Even those who don't live up to it live in an order where they know it's presumptive, right? They know they're not living up to something. So a life of prayer is presumptive and a significant order or segment of the culture is actually dedicated to a life of contemplation. In that context, civilization has a conversion of manners, and there is a general kind of elevation. Not manners as in drinking tea with one's pinky finger extended, but manners where the hard boundaries of charity are not where we begin, but we begin with the very wide and generous boundaries of good manners. Think of manners as a kind of perimeter defense of the virtues. Right? The manners themselves aren't virtues. Manners are not morals. Okay? But there are extended defensive perimeter around morals, right? You don't want to rely. I mean, it's one of the mercies of God. We don't properly rely on our charity. We don't want to have to rely on it. We're pretty weak and bad and stupid. So we don't want to lean heavily on our actual virtue all the time. We need to lean as often as possible on our habits of good manners. Right? So you don't cut off the person in traffic, okay? Not because you are consciously and deliberately, I don't know if Zach asked me this, but I'm often asked, I would like to be a teacher. What's the most important thing? Do you have any advice for me, Dr. Whalen? And I said, yes. My first piece of advice is ask advice of people who know something worth giving. In other words, go to somebody wise for advice, not me. But it is the case. I will go on to tell them that your primary, especially grade school and high school, your primary responsibility is to make the students fall in love with the subject. Also, to fall in love with a conversion of manners, that is, being civilized people. Fall in love with their deportment. And this all sounds so snotty, doesn't it? One minute I sound like I'm, you know, dressed in camos, and the next I sound as if, you know, we should all be waltzing our way to the parking lot. Tough. That's just, you're going to have to wrap your mind around it. It's in the book. So this is what you do as a teacher. It sounds sentimental. It sounds squishy. It sounds vaguely reminiscent of every dodge of moral responsibility that we have been disgusted with and abused by for the past 60, 70 years in lower and higher education. oh, we're just interested in loving the subject. You know, Frank Nellick used to say, if you meet the guru on the road, kill him. You know, if you meet somebody saying, education is all about love, cripple them. Maybe not kill them, but certainly remove their legs. I hope you understand the distinction. The first responsibility is to address the heart of the student so that you can get to the mind. You don't address the heart in order to avoid the mind. That's the distinction. Okay? Nor do you address the heart in order to win popularity contests, because it's not about you. It's about chemistry. And if you don't fall in love with chemistry, something's wrong with you. And yes, I know, very often something is wrong with you. You know, something's certainly wrong with me. But you get the point, right? You've got this. This thing is magnificent. God loves this thing. So should we. So he concludes by reminding everyone that the ultimate purpose of all education is that famous motto of the Jesuit order, for the greater glory of God. He begins the book and ends it with a reference to the Blessed Virgin Mary. And this book actually is a song, a kind of song in praise of the Blessed Virgin. I can talk later perhaps about why that is. Dr. Senior's devotion to the Blessed Virgin, he died praying the rosary. He died in the middle of an ave, literally died. His wife was kneeling next to the bed he was lying in, and he passed away in the middle of a Hail Mary. This, by his own standard, is the happiest of deaths. The Blessed Virgin, Dr. Senior taught us all to chant, even in our miserable vocal way, to chant the little office of the Blessed Virgin Mary every day, every weekday, in the academic year at the local Catholic church. And we incompetent, warbling, besotted souls would line up to 30 or 40 strong, and for that 20 minutes every afternoon at 4 p.m., the church actually became a little bit of heaven. That, in my own recollection, that 20-minute period every day, 4 o'clock in my undergraduate years, with young and old, mostly young, but chanting in Latin our, you know, very bad Gregorian chant, that still counts as the happiest moments of my life. And I'm no aesthete, and I'm no mystic. I'm as miserable as anybody, but that was obvious even to me, was a corner of heaven. We were with God doing what we will do in heaven if we're blessed enough to get there. So that's Dr. Senior's gift to me. It's Dr. Senior's gift to his students. Dr. Senior's gift to the world was this due appreciation for the Blessed Virgin's role in bringing people to her son, and therefore bringing people to their eternal beatitude. And on that note, I think I'll wrap it up and ask for questions. In the first part of what you said is literally in Senior. The second part of what you said is implicit in everything, and it may be in something else other than this book. But yes, the remark was, is it true that not just culture in the broadest sense, but even culture in the particular artistic sense, is the product of the Mass? Drama, modern drama, actually originates not in our continuation of Greek and Roman theater, but rather the theater that came out of the Mass, out of the liturgies of the Middle Ages, when those liturgies and those... You know the dramatic reading of the gospel on Palm Sunday? Okay, well, there were liturgies in the Middle Ages where that got a little more, became more robust, more performative. And at a certain point, the performance was clearly moving out of a liturgical context and into a performance context. And so it was, as you, I think you said, kicked out, you know, it was, well, let's do that on the steps of the church rather than in the church. And then you had the development of early medieval drama, out of which modern drama comes. And then later, the classics were sort of rediscovered. So yes, it's true. Art, painting, music, the church, Pope Benedict likes to make this point, right, that the church is the benevolent and enthusiastic parent or grandparent of almost all the arts, and is just as the Pope John St. John Paul II, the university, the colleges are themselves. They come out of the heart of the church. So the church is really the mother. The church really is the mother. Gives birth to all of these magnificent cultural expressions. I think Dr. Senior would not. I know he says the first part, but he would avow all of this with a caveat, and the caveat would be this: the value of the church lies not in the fact that these cultural byproducts are produced. The value of the church is in its being the mystical body of Christ. Those byproducts are testimony to its being the mystical body, not the mystical body exists in order to produce byproducts. Does that make sense? So you know, I mean our world has a very secular sort of default setting in the imagination. So we think, oh, I'm going to approve of the church because it ultimately, it gave us Shakespeare. And you say, well, no, it didn't really give you Shakespeare that way. What happened is it gave you Shakespeare because, A, Shakespeare had human nature that was edified and informed by the richness of the mystical body of Christ. That's what that is. I don't know if that makes any sense, but yes, that was out of Dr. Senior, certainly. Other questions? I was told that you were full of questions. I mean, I'm not going to let you go until you ask a lot of questions. Yes, sir. That's an excellent question. Dr. Senior used to say that theologians and philosophers argue vigorously that very question. At what point have we gone from, shall we say, is something no longer a tool, and has it become a machine? That's one interesting question. Another interesting question related would be, at one point is a machine or a tool helpful? How can we tell the difference between something being helpful and something being harmful, especially because it's helpful for X but harmful for Y? And how do we measure these things? That is the help against the harm. So he didn't present an answer. He didn't say that he had all this figured out. He put it more in more general and sweeping terms, and it would be this, and I'll get to you in just a second. For almost all of human history, ordinary life was lived according to recognizable patterns closely related to the natural operations of the created world. In about 100 years, that changed dramatically. So most people lived in rural environments doing rural things. And by rural, I don't mean necessarily agriculture. It could be craft. It could be, you know, what have you. But most people spent most of their times in rural environments doing productive things of one sort or another that involved manus, the hand, manual labor, okay, that involved craft of one sort or another, from you know, daily life from 1000 BC to 1700, 1750, pretty recognizably the same, despite all those great historical changes and difference. Daily life for most people, sheep behaved the same way, cattle behaved the same way, fences behaved the same way. It was a big deal in the Middle Ages when somebody invented the stirrup. Ooh, that was a big deal, you know. But from 1750, well, let's put it this way. In 1820, no, I'm sorry, in 1801, the vast majority of people in England lived in the countryside. By 1850, two-thirds lived in cities. So in 49 years, what had never before happened in human history had happened, and that is the urbanization and kind of mechanization of human society. Light, think of the 19th century. Essentially, the 19th century, more even than the 20th and the 21st century, was the century where ordinary human life for ordinary people was lived in a way that would not have been recognized by their parents, grandparents, forebears. So he would point to that. He would say, in 100 years, the entire way ordinary life was lived was transformed. I can't tell you exactly where or when or what. I it's beyond me. But I can look at the macro picture and say, you know what? We no longer are living in with the same experience of the created order. We're just not. And, you know, I'm very grateful for that every time I have a toothache or need penicillin, right? My wife would be dead now if it weren't for the surgeries that modern medicine, and Dr. Senior didn't hide from any of that. All of that's true. We're thankful and grateful for all of those things. And in many contexts, those things are themselves blessings and graces. But we being grateful for them does not allow us or does not force us, as it were, to forfeit the right to look at the macro picture and say, our sensibilities are not being shaped by the created order as they once were, and our ability to reason about such things has been impacted, don't like that verb, adversely. Yes, sir. Very good. Very good. I think a lot of people worship their iPhones. No, good point. Very good point. I will say this. There's a kind of divine practical joke on us. In point of fact, I mean, a philosopher or maybe a theologian would say, in point of fact, we do every technological innovation, every invention, be it material, mechanical, electronic, chemical, whatever, everything we have discovered, every manipulation of nature that we've manufactured or managed, is in principle and in fact a cooperation with nature. We have, until we can create ex nihilo, we're doomed to cooperate. That's all we get to do. But it doesn't feel like it, does it? It's not experienced on our part. Subjectively, it's not experienced as cooperation. It is experienced as mastery, right? And we talk about it. He quotes Bertrand Russell, who says, the purpose of science is to make nature sit up and beg. Right? That's the purpose of science. And this goes back to Bacon in the early modern period. You know, what we have to do is manipulate nature so that we can exercise control over it. So subjectively, even though technically we're cooperating, that's God's divine, practical joke on us. You know, we think we're mastering, but we're still just playing by his creation, as it were. We're still cooperating, but we are harming ourselves in that we are experiencing it as a kind of false autonomy, a false mastery, a false subjection of nature to our will. We're becoming spoiled. We expect nature just to do what we want. And how many of you, I mean, this is a stupid example, but no, this is a rhetorical question, don't answer. How many of you have been in a traffic accident, have been in a car accident? The first sensation everybody has if they are conscious and not physically damaged, harmed, the first sensation everyone has is surprise. They didn't really feel like they were going 40 miles an hour. The sensation of the crash is, oh, I didn't I didn't actually have any sense of my momentum until it suddenly stopped. I didn't really have any sense of this being a machine that I was in. I kind of felt like I was in an easy chair in my living room watching TV, and it turns out that I was actually in a metal box hurling down the street at even 25 miles an hour. It feels awfully fast when you suddenly come to a halt. So you know, we don't experience our mastery, or excuse me, our interaction with technology as actually still subjected to nature. We experience it as mastery. And when that mastery is ripped away from us all of a sudden, it's arresting. It's arresting. There was a sign of one more. I'm happy to go on and on and on and bore you to death, but the problem is I'm standing in between you and more wine. So that puts my own life in peril. So one more question. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Understandable. Right. Excellent question. Okay. My wife, okay, this is a terrific, so I would love to go on and on about this, but I understand that I should be brief. My wife, we have 20 acres. We live on 20 acres, and we don't farm. I'm not a farmer. I kill plants. In fact, if you go out into the garage, you can tell the division of labor is still exists. All of my tools are designed to kill things, and all of her tools are designed to grow them. It's really true, you know. All of hers are designed to grow, and mine are to destroy. So I have the whackers and the smackers and and the gasoline, and she's got, you know, the rototiller and all the little frames for tomatoes. So we tried to raise chickens, and finally we gave up, realizing we were not raising chickens for eggs. We were raising raccoon food. And it was, you know, let's not sentimentalize nature. My 3-year-old Robert wept for half a day when he and Janet, my wife, went out to the chicken coop to feed the little chicks. They had bought 20 brand new little chicks. They went out there, and there were 20 headless chick bodies. Raccoon, I mean, it had not even had a 3-course meal with it. It had just killed everyone, biting off their heads. And there's little pools of blood. I mean, it was pretty gross. And this 3-year-old was traumatized. So let's not be sentimental about the rhythms of nature. The rhythms of nature can be, you know, can be pretty. Now, wait a minute. Okay, I will boast about this. It's true. 4 years ago, the raccoon, one of the raccoons, was actually in a fight with another one, way up in a tree. So I don't have night vision equipment, and I don't have infrared rifles. By golly, I had a .22 and a flashlight, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, I nailed that sucker 25 feet in there. You heard his body go boom, 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 boom. So, you know, I'm not proud. I'm, you know, I write books and I write things. I'm kind of proud of my scholarship, and you know, I'm an okay teacher. I haven't been fired yet. I'm all right with most things. I'm really proud of nailing that raccoon. I'll boast in public about that. Okay, but let me come back to your question, which is a very serious one. Principal Dr. Senior used to repeat over and over, run, walk, do not run, walk, out of the 20th century. We would say 21st. Do not attempt dramatic, radical, heroic, impossible, ludicrous, transparently ridiculous extremes to reintegrate oneself with the natural order or the natural rhythms, operations of the created order. Do what is within one's reach reasonably without going nuts and becoming kind of, you know, some sort of Catholic Amish, right? So I say that because a friend of mine actually did that and wrote a book about it called Switched Off, Eric Brendy. It's a really quite a good book. I highly recommend it. But what Dr. Senior says in this book, you remember, he's just turn off the television, read aloud, sing, recreate, eat together. I mean, if a modern family ate together regularly, read of an evening together, and it's all ages. I mean, last night I'm not a paragon of virtue, but I was reading Winnie the Pooh to my 4-year-old. I enjoy it. Winnie the Pooh is really good stuff, you know, not the Disney version, you know, the real, it's really good stuff. And Beatrix Potter is fantastic. And then, of course, Grimm is fantastic. And we didn't even get into the good books, great books distinction, which is its whole, a whole nother conversation. But these activities can include the whole or almost all of the family. Okay. If one were to do that regularly of an evening, and that alone, that would revolutionize the world. I mean, think about it. Dr. Senior says, if you can do just those things, smash the or turn off the television, walk away from the computer, read aloud, sing, play, dine together. If you do nothing but that, maybe have a garden. Yes, have a chicken or two if you can, but you don't have to. Don't have a goat. Boy, I'm glad my wife doesn't know you. She's arguing for a goat. So anyway, no goats. But I still have the 22. I don't even know the man, and I'm threatening his goat. This talk has officially gone off the rails. So seriously, if one is to do just those things, just those, and you do it with neighbors, what if you know three or four families that live kind of like that? And what if you're friends? And what if you even live in some proximity? What if on the same block? He actually does this in the book. He says, you know, someone's going to open up a little shop, and someone's going to open up a little bar where the men go to drink because they're happy and not to get happy, which is the difference between drink and drunkenness. Okay, and a tea shop where the women will go to converse and talk and share the news of the day. In other words, do you see what he's doing? He's talking about suddenly that alone would start radiating a kind of mini culture that when it becomes normative, is the culture. So I think we don't even have to be that dramatic and aspirational. All we have to say is an ordinary family living like that, which is doable, it's very doable, is radically different from almost all contemporary Western families, and radically better. You don't want to be snotty about it, but it's really true. Just that. You don't have to grow your own wheat. I mean, good if you do. Although, again, reason means, I'll say this and shut up. I know you're all itching to go. Prudence means that you recognize how the principle is applied to the practice of your particulars, your circumstances. For some people, that can actually mean growing almost all their own food, raising their own animals, making money on the farmer's market on weekends, and living as gentleman farmers or full-time farmers or just people with a nice garden, half of which is flowers anyway. It depends on the circumstances and the abilities. If I were to do this because I have no talent, I'm better at craft, that is working with wooden things, than I am with plants. So, you know, let someone do the plants, let someone else fix the rototiller or whatever. Do you see what I mean? You apply the principle of integrate yourself as much as one can reasonably with the operations of the created order. And that's going to differ from person to person. And unfortunately, Catholics love rule books. We love, spell it out, give it to me, this is what I do, and then I'm okay. That's not prudence. You adapt it to your circumstances with the principle in mind and the realities of your situation in mind at the same time. Why don't we, you have a follow-up? Catholamish, Thomish. That was probably Providence then, you know. That's a Catholic Amish. Very good. Well, thank you all. And let's talk afterwards. All right. Thank you.